Tonight on episode 35 of Rock Under Fire, Richie Rano, legendary guitar player of the classic rock band Stars.
Hey, welcome to episode 35 of the Rock Under Fire podcast.
Yeah.
We have Richie Rano today.
Can't wait for that, man. Seems like a cool dude. God knows what he's seen.
RockunderFire.com, that's our website. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, Rock Under Fire on iTunes, Rock Under Fire on YouTube. Subscribe to that, too. Like our Facebook page. Follow us on Twitter. I am Mike DiRico, and I am with Stick Nixon.
Hi.
We are your hosts for episode 35. We don't have Pat with us. Patrick Ivanitsky.
Well, why is the seat to my right empty?
Because family and health comes first, and he has a sick kid. So,
just playing that sick
Patrick
kid card.
Is not with us for today.
Kids.
Incriminating stuff, I tell you,
that's
man.
That's why I don't want kids.
And, a lot of stuff, man, that we had to cut from this one because just stuff that we were privy to, man. But I guess the general public who listens to this show is not going to be privy to because we decided collectively with our guest that we don't release certain portions of this conversation. It's fun nonetheless, man. It was a great discussion. And I guess we'll get to that in a few minutes, man. What do we got? Did anybody die? I think this is the first week where nobody died between episodes.
I think.
No, well, nobody in music died. Nobody big in music that we know of. Or am I missing
something?
You're
right, man. I think no one died, which we almost never see.
You know what's going to happen, man? As soon as this episode is released, after I go back and do all the editing and all that stuff, and we have that 2-week gap between episodes, that's when somebody's going to die.
Mm-hmm.
It always happens when we can't do or say anything about it. And it's already after the fact by the time we get to talk about it.
Yeah. Still plenty of time in 2017 for tragedies.
I just wish somebody would die the day before we record, you know? If somebody's got to die, because I don't wish somebody would die,
right.
But you know what I mean. I would rather they die the day before we record rather than 2 weeks before. You know what I mean? It always happens right after we fucking record an episode, and then we have another 2 weeks before we record again.
By the time people listen to us, they're already.
It's already old news. That's my point.
Yeah. So what did go on in music this week then? Before we get to Richie, man, anything go on?
I don't know, but I'm really pissed off because PBS was airing at the documentary on John Coltrane, which played in the Village about 6 months ago. And I said, you know what? It was a period where I just couldn't get out. And we made a couple plans with our friend Dr. Marlowe.
Yes,
and
you
I
remember him.
Make that, and I couldn't make it out to see the documentary on John Coltrane. And I've been dying to see this, and PBS aired it Monday night. I was going to set the DVR thing, whatever that box thing, you know, because I don't watch TV. I only mm-hmm. watch what I record, and I, you know, 6 months later, or rainy days, and I fucking forgot to address it. I forgot to set the DVR
right.
thing, and I totally missed it, so now I got to go through PBS's schedule and hope that they're showing it again. And the only other thing that I could think of is that Ozzy just announced his annual farewell tour.
Yeah.
And apparently this farewell tour is going to run for 2 years again like the last one did.
Maybe Pat would be, but I'm not interested. I saw that footage of Bark at the Moon. No thanks.
Oh, from the eclipse.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of times vocalists, when they get... the aging vocalists in order to deal with their vocal issues, they lower their music at least a half step down so they can sing it. Some of them lower it a full step in order to be able to sing what they once sang back in the 70s.
Wow.
And
Ozzy's on the elevator now.
Ozzy is like, you know, it sounded like, is what's his name? The guitarist. What's his fucking name?
Zakk Wylde.
Zakk Wylde. It sounded like Zakk Wylde was tuned in C.
Mm.
And Ozzy was still struggling to sing it, to bark at the moon.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know.
What we're trying to say is you're not going to get a real...
been worse, man. Well, that's why this is his latest farewell tour.
Yeah.
I think he did the right thing for himself, I guess, by, you know, first he laid Sabbath to rest. He put them to bed. Last year's farewell tour was the Sabbath farewell tour,
right.
The end. So I think he dealt with them, got rid of them this way to assure that Sabbath would not reform again without him before he retires. So now he can safely, you know, go and have his farewell tour in peace, knowing that Sabbath is now,
and I'm sure,
no longer an entity.
I'm sure the Ozzy farewell tour, for his point of view, is a lot more economical, if you know what I mean. Man.
Possibly, yeah.
He doesn't have to split the money with the other guys.
All right, what do you got?
You know, there was some gossipy news, gossipy rock and roll news this week. Compliments to Dee Snider. And I'm with Dee all the way on this one, on this thing I got here.
I just hope we don't have to use the four-letter word again, man.
Nope.
Good, because, you know, when we were talking with Richie, when we were talking with Richie, it was just like, you know, he said, I don't want to discuss, you know, and I was like, you know what, that's exactly where we are with this podcast. Okay, so go ahead, man.
It may be maybe too much shorthand for some of you guys.
Dee Snider.
But, yeah, Dee Snider is on social media this week attacking people for wearing heavy metal shirts. Celebrities are doing this. Rocking a Judas Priest shirt, the Maiden shirt, and they're not fans of the band. And he said, heavy metal is not ironic, dicks.
Well, that's what it's become, D. You know, unfortunately. Dee Snider, if you're listening, I wish you would return my email. Seriously, because I did write you, and I really want to have you on our show to discuss some very, very good ideas that you had on your podcast 2 years ago. And it seems that I'm the only one that wants to address it. And it was a very good idea that you had. So please return my email. Go back in your email, email that you've gotten from 20. I believe I sent it to you in 2016 sometime. But go back and you'll find that I picked up on some of your ideas.
Send them a fresh one.
Yes. Well, that's what I probably need to do at this point.
But that would be lovely to have D. We're getting a little more popular all the time, man. People will hear you. They will hear you if you go on. Is that what it's come down to, though, now? Heavy metal is an ironic shirt. You know how you go out and you buy your He-Man and the Masters of the Universe shirt ironically? Or your Frosted Flakes, they're great because you're a hipster and it's cool. Is that what people are doing now? Like, weren't even born when the Rock and Rio album came out, wearing the Iron Maiden shirt?
Being what it is today, the fact that they're... just is no main. There's no place in the mainstream for rock anymore. That the few kids that do get into rock, it's become like almost like a punchline,
yeah.
Fashionably, where, you know, you see fashion models wearing the Rolling Stones tongue logo or something. You know, and I think we talked about. I mentioned this briefly in our either the Ed Sheeran episode or the how guitar became uncool episode. One of those two episodes, we talked briefly about this,
right.
But kids are getting into rock music through video games.
Yep.
A lot of these, you know, those Guitar World, Guitar Player, whatever guitar, what's that thing? Guitar Hero?
Guitar Hero.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gee, we're really coming across as like old miserable farts sometimes.
When
I listen to the playback, I'm like, what's wrong with these guys, man? Oh, that's us.
I've had that thought. We're either on the fucking money or we're just old, crinkly, crotchety old men, man. One or the other, man. Waiting for this piece to upload. But it is ridiculous, like wearing a product and representing any entity that you have no idea what it is. Why walk around with a Priest shirt on or an Ozzy shirt if you have no idea what you're representing? I'll give my girlfriend credit. Nicole looks great in this old Ozzy shirt of mine. She won't wear it, man,
I have to admit, I did that one time.
With who?
Just as far as like a kitschy, campy element, and I wore a Spice Girls shirt on stage.
Oh, you did?
I remember when I won't name the location, but it was kind of local. And I went on stage, and it was around 1998, and I wore a Spice Girls shirt that I got for free at Spencer's, I think, man. I don't know what it was, but they were giving away Spice Girls.
You got it for free, I take it too. Let me read this while it's up. Dee Snider knows a thing or two about metal fashion, but it seems the overabundance of celebrities wearing metal tees has gotten to the Twisted Sister frontman. Kanye West is notorious for wearing heavy metal shirts out in public. We've seen Metallica shirts worn by Gigi Hadid, Michael Jackson's daughter, Justin Bieber, and Kim Kardashian. But celebrity stylists getting their clients to wear vintage metal shirts is one thing. Big-time fashion brands have begun taking notice and blatantly ripping off metal logos in some cases. It feels like H&M released the line of metal logo t-shirts. Urban Outfitters sold overpriced band shirts, too. I have no idea what Gucci was thinking of with this AC/DC design. And they have big brands like Supreme teaming up with Black Sabbath and Slayer for limited lines. D. Snyder's not having it anymore. It's not. We'll get to it when we get to it.
Yeah, man. Well, yeah, I get the gist of it.
I've done. It puts you on a douche list. I mean, if you're wearing a rock shirt from Van just to be stylish, you may be a douche. It's like driving a Lamborghini. Douche list. Anyone that listens to this K-pop, Korean pop, or any kind of EDM at all, douche list. So, like, Lamborghini, fake rock shirt, listening to electronic music, all douchey. I do wear one douchey shirt, though, but I have my own version of that, where I walk into the room with this shirt on. It's like, douche!
What shirt is that?
Isn't my my ironic Boy Scout shirt in that category? Oh, yeah, I have a Boy Scout shirt that I wear. Has with the state of Wyoming on it. It says Troop 62 or something like that. And I put logos of different bands on it. Oh, speaking of an overused logo, the friggin' Misfit skull. Stop wearing it if you don't know what it is. That's on my Boy Scout shirt. And this thing, we're not getting the rest of this piece, but you get the drift. You get the drift, man. I don't know. Some people say, though, that turns kids on to rock and roll. Whatever it takes. If you start with the logo, maybe they'll start to listen. Maybe we are being old and crotchety, but no, I'm with D. Heavy metal horns are ours.
At this point, man, I don't care. I don't fucking. I'm just, you know, we're at. This is episode 35. We've talked about this 34 other times. You know, it keeps coming up like agita. You know,
we got to get to Richie. Is Richie on the line?
Richie, well, yeah, we had a really great discussion with Richie. He gave us a lot more time than I had anticipated. You know, given that he had a
right.
Probably up really late last night. He's going to be up again late tonight.
Yeah,
he's got a show. But he's also kind of it was an inspirational talk, man, because the fact that he's still out there doing it, man. You know, and I went into it saying, "Nah, I'm a musician. I play guitar too, and I gave it up 17 years ago, and I don't miss it."
Right.
I don't want to fucking get up on like a fucking.
You have regrets about what you
fucking
said?
Fucking PA speaker up a flight of stairs at three. No, right. I still don't want to do that.
Yeah,
I just want to get my guitar,
drift,
get on the stage, play the show, walk the fuck off, and get in my car and go home. That's what I like.
Yeah.
You know, if I can't do that, then I'm going to sit at a microphone and have a podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And
see the choice that we've made.
Yeah. I don't want to deal with the other guitar player forgot the riff, or the drummer thinks it's too hard, or just any of the old drama that goes back to Live Animals when we were playing way back.
That's
in
our
the
old
day,
band,
back in the 90s, and the cover band that we used to have.
So,
yeah, I don't miss that.
Instead of that, we'll sit back and criticize your music. How's that?
We're going to criticize your music, and we're going to tell you everything that's wrong with rock and roll. And occasionally we get it right by having really cool guests. And today we got it right. We had a really great discussion with, one of the unsung influences of 1970s classic rock, man, and just a legendary guitar player. And just an all-around great guy, as we came to find out in this discussion with Richie Rano.
Yeah.
Did you get that sense too, man? That we were just like talking to fucking greatness, man, and just overall coolness, man. Just
he was
fucking cool dude.
Cool to the bone.
Cool guy.
Seeing God knows what, and I could totally imagine like chilling out, like bringing a six-pack over and watching a game with the dude and having a lot of laughs.
I went into it thinking, you know what, he did a gig last night. He was up, again, he was up late, probably up early, you know, because he had said some other business that he had to take care of, so he's probably in a, crappy mood.
Yeah.
So I kind of went into it thinking, okay, we'll be lucky if we get a half hour out of him. But then, he said, you know what, he made us feel relaxed, we made him feel relaxed. He picked up that we knew our shit. And that always goes a long way, I guess, in in doing an interview.
I hope the listener perceives, man, as it goes on, that we become all of us more comfortable with each other, man.
I think he kind of was on it, you know, because when I guess I could only imagine things from the artist's end of it, where you kind of go into it saying, okay, is this going to be another discussion where the person asking a question is the same five questions for the past 30 years? Somebody that has no fucking clue who I really am, like that. So I get it.
Yeah,
I get it. I think on both our parts, I think the discussion went very well. I think we revealed a few things that he says that he never really talked about. I guess
one or two exclusives.
Things that we are privy to that the general listener is not going.
Can
to
you
be
imagine? Yeah,
we're gonna edit some of this, but by the time this gets, you know, you could only imagine what the gossip.
Woo-hoo,
is.
You guys are missing out.
Yeah, man. All right, so with that, I guess we'll go to our discussion with Richie.
Really quick, the reason Mike's not plugging his gig tonight, in case you're wondering, is that by the time you guys hear this, the gig will be over.
Yeah.
Because he has to mix it. So.
But if you want to find out a little bit more about Richie and what's available and out there in terms of music and merchandise and just a general sense of who our guest is, if you don't already fucking know by now, go to starscentral.com. With that, episode 35, we will go to our discussion with Richie.
Time with him in the studio.
We were close friends. But going back, I was in the group Stories, you know, Brother Louie?
Right.
You know that song? All right. So I was in that band, and we had, I joined them after the song went to number one. The guitar player quit when the song went to number one, and I was one of, I think it was 17 guitar players to audition. And I got the job. You know, there I was, 23 years old, all of a sudden in a group of the number one record. It was a lot of fun. So we started, you know, we recorded some more songs, and Kerner and Wise were the producers, and I'm sure you know who they are. We were sitting in the studio. I was doing a solo on some song, and I'd gotten very friendly with Richie and Kenny. They were really good guys. And Richie flashes this album up in my face. I'll never forget it because it was such a weird cover. And I said, "What is that?" And he said, "What do you mean?" He said, "It's this new group I'm producing." I said, "Yeah, but I don't understand what the picture is. Is that like a drawing, cartoon or something?" He goes, "No, it's their faces." I said, "How could it be their faces? What the hell is this thing?" You know, it was like really, it like really took me back. You know, it was like, "What the hell is this?" And they said, "No, they paint their faces to look like that." I said, "Well, what kind of music is it?" And they said, "Really great hard rock."
Right.
I said, "Really?" I said, "No kidding." I said, "No, I'd love to hear it." They said, "Well, this is a promo copy. I think it was like 2 weeks early, this promo copy." He said, "Just take my promo copy," which I still have to this day. And I love that album to this day. I tell you, I love that album. And I took it on the road with me on a cassette, and I played it, you know, when we were on tour with Stories. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, we're in L.A. at the small hotel. And who's staying there? Kiss and Stories. And I got friendly with them right away. They were in the swimming pool in leather.
Yeah.
Up to their chests. Up to their chests at midnight when we checked in, and they were drinking champagne. And I said, "You guys are nuts." And we instantly hit it off. I went into the studio with them and hung out, and because Kerner and Wise are producing too, so it was very, you know, it was very comfortable, you know. And they came to our gigs, and we became friends. And they said, "You should get a group together and get over to Bill O'Coin's Rocksteady Management. You're a great hard rock player. You should quit this band." I said, "Well, I'm not quitting a band with a number one record, but thank
right.
you." Anyway, 6 months later, the group split up. I tried getting a band together to go to O'Coin. I couldn't get the right people. And then this group called the Fallen Angels was holding an audition, and it was in the Village Voice, and my ex-roadie, guitar roadie from Stories, saw it and said, "Look, it's Rocksteady Management. They got a group. This is perfect for you." So I was the 74th guitar player to walk into audition.
Well, at the outset, man, let me just, I got to put this out there because I know you did, I know you're between gigs. You did a gig last night. You have one coming up tonight. I'm a musician. I played guitar for about 34 years. I stopped playing about 17 years ago. So it's been that long since I've been on a stage in front of any sort of crowd.
Wow.
What the only thing I miss is the actual show. I don't miss lugging equipment or up and down a flight of stairs at 3 a.m. I don't miss the domestic squabbles or band practice, none of that. And, you know, I'm going through the entire arc of your career and all the, you know, the ups and downs, the various projects over the years, including the present. and I'm going through your social media and the things that the thing that strikes me the most, man, about you is despite the ups, the downs, the obvious downside of the industry, you're still doing it, man. You know, you're still musically active. It's an ongoing effort with you. You're doing what, two, three gigs a week. You're for real, man.
It's
in your fucking blood, man. What, where does that come from, man? What keeps you going?
Okay, I'm glad you asked. That's a great question, and thanks for spending the time to research the person you're interviewing, which is really, that's a smart thing to do. I've done interviews where people don't even know what bands I was in. I don't know why they're doing the interview. But I've done interviews where they don't even talk about anything about me. Those are
we have some questions for you, man.
I think it's pretty funny when that stuff happens. But anyway, it's a great question, and I literally got out of playing music three times already in my life. And when I burn out on something, I want nothing to do with it. Just like I am with the Kiss thing and the Kiss Expo thing.
Right.
I want nothing to do with it. And I did that. It happened to me with music in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
And it was right after so many horrible things had happened to me in the career, not physically, thank God, but in my career, like just the weirdest things happened. And the last thing that I had done was, I made a Hellcats album with Michael Lee Smith from Stars and myself.
Right.
And Peter Scantz, who was on the phone before. That's why I had to get off the pause for a second. Peter Scantz on bass, and we had a guy named Doug Maddock, and we made a great, great album. We called it Hellcats. They signed us as Stars, but we felt like we changed so many members that in respect to those members, we wanted to call it Hellcats. I look back now, I realize that was a major mistake, but we did it anyway because that's what we do. And,
I kind of like it. I like the logo. It was kind of like I don't know. I just personally liked it.
The Hellcats?
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, and it was a great album, and we knew. I mean, I listened back to it. And I go, holy shit, man! We really had something great, and it was doing really well in England, and it was getting national radio play, and the record company was telling us it's going to go through the roof. This is really great, right? So our manager, Rick Stewart, hooked up a tour with Ted Nugent. The record company was going to subsidize it because that's what happened with new bands in those days. And we were all getting psyched, and we said, this is great. This is really great. It was 1983-ish, late 83, I think it was. One day he called the label. The label was called Radio Records. It was a subsidiary of Atlantic, but it was still its own entity.
Okay, that was one of the things I wanted to ask you about.
Have you heard of it?
I never heard of the subsidiary, but I've always just associated Hellcats with Atlantic, so I wanted to ask you about that. So you kind of answered one of my questions.
Like, in fact, like when we did the cover and all that stuff, we went up to the Atlantic Records. They used their photographer, their art department, but technically it was Radio Records. So our manager calls me one day and he goes, I can't get through to the label. It's just busy signal all day. I said, that's not good. That's weird. Huh. And they were in Florida. So I said, well, what are we going to do? I said, you better call Atlantic. So he calls Atlantic. Radio went under. They just went under.
Wow.
And so I said, well, now what? And he said, I don't know. And two of the guys lived in L.A. and two of us lived in Jersey. So he said we were too hoping Atlantic could pick it up, but they said contractually they're not allowed to. I mean, I guess they would have had to sign us. We would have had to get an advance. We would have had to go re-record the stuff, all kinds. I don't know what it entailed, but I just gave up. I said, that's it. I'm out. And I just started doing other things. I didn't play anymore at all. I just played in the house, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't think I missed it, to be honest with you. Like I say, it's my personality. When I've been doing it since I was 15, and now I was 34 at that time, nonstop. I mean, you know, I lived it, and that's what you have to do. You have to live it if you think you're going to do anything in the music business. You can't have a full-time job and say, oh, yeah, I play on the weekends. I'm really hoping to break through to the next level, because you're not going to. So at any rate, I just gave up. I had two little kids, 3 years old and 5, 6 years old at the time, and I said, screw it. And I didn't miss it, but I kept writing stuff at home and recording stuff on a little TAC Porta studio. And then finally in 91, you know, I got divorced in 89. And then for the next couple of years, it was kind of tough. And then, you know, then you start finding yourself again and you start realizing how much you do really love to play guitar. And I started doing gigs, like just on Wednesday nights I only played, or Thursday nights, actually. I still have the flyer on the wall here, believe it or not.
Yeah.
And that was 91. And then I started writing stuff, and Peter Scantz and I were back together, and we started a really cool band, and we couldn't think of a name of it, so we just ended up calling it RRG, which stood for Richie Rano Group.
Mm-hmm.
And we recorded a great album, and we had some distributor to, I can't remember what they were called, the name of the company, and they were supposed to promote it and sell it, and it was a great album. I hate to say great things about myself, but in truth, the band was great, and it's not myself, but the band was great, and the album was great, and once again, nowhere. And I said, you know what, I don't want to play covers. This is what I do, is I write and do this, and I said, I'm done. And in 97, I quit again.
Was that the label, or was that the distributor that put out a couple of, there was a series of live releases from Stars that came out back in the 90s. Would that happen to be the same?
Was that Performance?
I don't know if that was Performance. I don't know what it was. But it was just, I was going through your discography.
Put some stuff out on us, but that was just like little, you know.
I don't think it was. It was King something.
I don't remember. This wasn't an actual label. It was a distribution company.
Yeah.
I can't even remember the name of it.
Yeah.
It's 20 years ago. I just don't remember the name of it. So
the whole freaking industry's
a mess.
We
didn't get a dime, as usual. I sent them all the CDs. We didn't get a penny. So it just cost money. And I just said, you know, I'm done. I'm not playing covers. And we were having a really tough time getting gigs as an original band, with not doing any other music but Richie Rano Group songs, and nobody cared, you know, really. Mm-hmm. And it was really tough, and I just said, screw it. So I got done again, and then in 2001, I started playing Sunday nights in a little bar here in Paramus. And slowly but surely, I just was really feeling good about it. And 2003, we put Stars back together because we had gotten some offers, and we just talked about it and said, let's do it. And that's what happened. And I realized, though, the reasons why I quit the first two times, that I would quit again if I let those things get to me. And so now I just said, I'm not going to let those things get to me. And when people want to hear cover tunes, I won't even play an original, even if they ask.
Wow.
Just playing cover tunes. Because ultimately, what I really love doing is playing the guitar. And it really doesn't matter what I'm playing. I finally came to that realization. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's where I've come to also, man. And we kind of piggybacking on what you were saying. What is the status of the next Stars record? Is there going to be one? I know a couple of years back you were involved in the Frontiers label, and it was around 2015. At this point, and I know given the nature and the state of the industry, it gets to the point where bands have to ask, you know, is it viable to record an album? Is it even worth it at this point? What is going, what's the status of that record? Or does it exist? Does it?
We gave the money back, not because of anything other than we just, we recorded like five songs and they never got completed. And I guess it really doesn't matter what the reason why they didn't get completed was, but it got to the point where I did the deal, and I felt like, it was time to either give the money back or finish it right at the spot. And I asked the label, I said, look, I can't give you a date of when it's going to be done. I'm sorry. We're running into some problems. And would you like the money back? And they said, after a few days, they said, you know, we think we would. So I sent the money back. And, of course, we spent a good 25% of that money, so mm-hmm. We lost that money too. But what happened not long after that was I hooked up with Jimmy Koons. You know who he is?
The name doesn't ring a bell.
He's been the singer of Cactus for the last since they regrouped about 13 years ago.
Okay.
And he's really, really great. And we started writing together and recording. So we got about an album's worth of music done, and we're going to try and get a recording, you know, some kind of little recording contract on that. It's all demos, so we still have to get a budget and redo them, you know.
Yeah.
But in fact, Jimmy and I are on the new Gods tribute CD that just came out a few days ago.
Nice.
Yeah. You like the Gods?
I don't know too much about the Gods.
Yeah.
I don't know them too much. Well, but I know of
them.
They had
a great song, Gotta Keep Her Running, it's called. Really cool song, and we did that one for the CD that just came out.
You know, and I dare say the four-letter word again, man. They reminded me of Kiss from what I heard. But just back at the, you know, this was about 5-6 years ago, somebody, you know, told me about the Gods. I said, why don't I know about these guys? It was like one of those, you know, like, shit, like, where has this band been? And just one of those things that you put on your musical to-do list and just never fucking surfaces, man.
Well, they were on Casablanca. And, you know, every Kiss fan, when they see a Casablanca label, just gets, you know, they think Donna Summer's like Kiss. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's on Casablanca, man, you know?
You see Rocksteady or Casablanca, and all of a sudden it's Kiss-related, you know?
Right.
But it's really not necessarily.
Kiss boner.
You know, I really didn't think that Stars had really anything musically to do with Kiss, but
no.
Other than a couple of riffs that I wrote that, because I loved Kiss, I really did. I thought they were really great at what they did. I know people think they suck. I don't think they suck. I think they're great. But I did write a couple of little licks that just, you know, in a couple of songs, like Live Wire. I don't know if you know the song, but
yeah,
it definitely borrowed some Kiss stuff in that song. But
I think some of your influences borrowed some stuff from you. You know, getting into the people that cited you guys as influences, right down to the song titles, man. I don't need to name the band names, but Live Wire, Fallen Angels, you know.
Certainly the song titles, Monkey Business. Somebody else has a Monkey Business, and then there's every rose has its thorn, which is basically a copy of Third Time's the Charm.
Third Time's the Charm, yeah.
There's no question. And but you know what? That's okay. It was nothing. It wasn't plagiarism necessarily, you know. It wasn't.
No.
And
what did he say? Imitation.
I mean,
something.
If any plagiarism, it might be Cat Scratch Fever.
Mm-hmm.
That's exact. It's exact riffs that I do in Monkey Business, and we were playing with Ted, and he would sit right by the side of the stage. There, stand by the side of the stage and watch us, and then he went into the dressing room and he played Cliff Davies. I don't care if Ted hears this. He played Cliff Davies, this new riff, and Cliff said, "Oh, I know where that came from." And
I know it's a cliche, man, but it is true. You guys, the music did sound ahead of its time in the sense of, I could take like So Young, So Bad, okay, the riff in that. It's four chords, four chords. Okay. That became a very common chord progression in the 80s, and I can't, you know, I can't sit here and name names because I can't think of any offhand, but it sounds so familiar, that chord progression, that you didn't really hear it before you played it, you know. And then it's kind of like, you know, what you listen to, and then I'm not just keeping it, you know, it's not exclusive to hard rock and metal. Like, I hear
song,
I hear fucking
there, like,
38 Special. Yeah. You know, 38 Special took that song and made three songs out of it.
You like Group Train? What was that great song? It charted for like 200 weeks on the charts. Like
Drops
kind
of Jupiter or something like that.
No, not that one. That's from the early 90s. It's the one from like 7 or 8 years, 5, 6, 7. It's about 7 years ago.
Yeah, I wouldn't know. That's the only one.
It's
the only
same
one.
Same chords. It's exact same chords.
Yeah.
But give Michael the credit for that. Michael wrote those chords. Of course, he didn't sound like that when he kind of had it sound like a folk song, but it was his chords. He wrote
Michael Lee Smith. We credit with So Young, So Bad from Coliseum Rock.
Well,
fourth Stars album. Just jumping off the... I'm hearing an echo now.
Where are we getting the echo chamber now? What's up with that?
Hold on, let me see if I can fix this.
Okay, right. I'm not hearing anything. I got a little bit of a flanger.
What do you make of the current state of rock right now?
Totally. There is a current state of rock? I didn't know there was one.
Exactly. I like this guy, man. You need to co-host the show with us. For our audience, I apologize for the echoing.
Is this live? No.
No, everything is pre-recorded. But you know what it is? I have you.
Okay,
this is like the most ghetto setup you ever want to see. So I have you coming out of speakers. I have two speakers mic'd up for your voice. I'm running a wire to my phone, and you're coming out of two speakers.
That's probably what created the echo.
So there's some, like, the two microphones are kind of bleeding together.
Right.
I think that's what's happening.
Where were we before I did that?
As far as the current state of rock and roll, you know, our show, we kind of look at, you know, we kind of take that sentence, you know, rock and roll is dead. Rock is dead. And we kind of, is it dead, or is it just kind of dead as we once knew it?
No, it's dead. It's dead. And the reason it's dead is because the powers that be realized that they could make a lot of money on rap music without spending a lot of money to record it, because what do you need to record it? And rap music is what killed it. And if you go to Europe, they don't have rap music. Rap music didn't. It never caught on there. And there is a rock scene in Europe and Japan, where rap is useless. It didn't happen there. So it is definitely rap that killed it, and I think it's like a poisoning of the musical brain of, you know, the developing musical brain of a teenager, child, or a teenager. When they hear that garbage, you know, it's it does something to the like it's a tonal thing, I think, like a pitch thing, and real music doesn't register with them anymore. That's my theory. I've never heard anyone else say that. That's my personal theory. I could be completely wrong. But that's what I think.
You have to get there first, too. I think you have to get like a young boy accustomed to the use of the sound of the electric guitar early. You know, get him used to what a real guitar and bass and drums sound like. Plant that seed, and
I don't know. I really don't know.
But
I don't know if that's what you know. Maybe that's what kind of what I'm saying. So maybe
There's still a lot of rock and roll kids out there, you know, whose dads are doing a good job. You know, it's coming from dad.
Yeah,
you know, this is Led Zeppelin. Check this out. You know, but
I teach guitar, and I do have some kids that just love, you know, rock guitar. And I explain to them, don't listen to current music. There's no reason to.
Yeah.
I said, you want to play guitar? Don't, you know, because I've had kids come to me and they want to learn a song and they play me the song. I go, there's no guitar in the song.
Right.
Why do you listen to that?
Yeah, what do you want to play exactly?
Do you want to play guitar or don't you? Listen to the songs that have guitar in them if you want to play the guitar, you know?
You got to go back in time and dig your roots. You got to.
Well, you know what?
Young kid.
If you want to learn to play guitar, listen to the 70s. That's where the greatest guitar playing was.
Absolutely.
Late 60s through 70s.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, I guess the 80s to some degree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, Mike just mentioned, I mean, we talk about this so much on our show. It's kind of like our mission statement that rock and roll is dead, essentially. You seem to feel the same way. And so many of our old rock gods that are hanging in there, you know, still doing it. Like, here we go again, Kiss. They're still doing it somehow. Ozzy, Priest, the list goes on. But so many of these guys look and sound awful. But let me finish my point, bro. I want to kiss your ass, bro, because I went last night on YouTube and I was watching recent footage of you guys. And, dude, you're damn good. You know, your singer still sounds great. You still sound great.
Sound great.
And you look cool. You don't look like ridiculous caricatures of yourself like so many of our old heroes do. I want to tell you that. I really enjoyed that when I watched it.
Well, thank you. Actually, he's not going to be singing with us for a while, and we haven't done any gigs in over two years. So I asked him, if it's okay if we get a sub for a while until he's ready to sing again. So Jimmy's going to sing. Jimmy Coons is going to actually sing with us. We're starting off doing gigs in January in Texas, and it's going to be a little weird not having Mike with us. But I said, Mike, I will only do this if it's good with you.
Which a blessing.
He said, no, I know you guys want to play and you deserve to play. So he goes, you guys get out there. I got to take care of some stuff.
Okay.
And so I said, okay, that's fine then. And I said, Jimmy knows he's a sub.
Handled it like
and
big
if it
boys.
Lasts a year, whatever it is, he knows, you know. So, but we're going to get back out there. And it's the same four guys that we've been playing together for, you know, a while, obviously. And then Jimmy singing.
Excellent.
So this is the first time that I'm announcing it in public. So whenever your interview goes out, we haven't announced that we have a different singer until just now.
You heard it. Rock
heard
under
it first.
Fire.
Rock under fire.
You guys got an exclusive.
Contact TMZ, man.
Excellent. Before TMZ. Fuck TMZ.
You know what? He'll do justice to him. He's a big Stars fan, and he has the utmost respect for Michael and the music. You know, he's really a big Stars fan, which is how we connected in the first place, Jimmy and I.
Yeah.
So,
Just even if the, you know, like the good bands today, and there are a few, I can name them on one hand and have fingers left over. But there are, you know, it all comes out of this digital age thing, you know, and it's a speck on the ass of that era when bands knew how to make records, you know. And one of my personal favorite periods is 76 to around 1980, and what I call the ear candy era, and that's bands like Stars and early Cheap Trick and Thin Lizzy, and even the Cars, in a different way, you know, where it was just so
I kind of like the Cars,
catchy, and you guys and bands like you guys, like the first three Cheap Trick albums, those early the Thin Lizzy records, it was that perfect balance of primitive and I dare say, like Gloss, man, where it was not totally smooth over because you still had the primitive nature of early rock and roll, you know,
yeah.
And it was and
yeah.
it was hard edge, but it was still catchy. You know, it was
melodic.
Catchy enough to very melodic, and it was melody, and you had that gift. You had the gift of melody.
Well, when I joined Stars, Michael and I really connected right away, and I said, you know, and this is interesting. I never really said this either before, but it's true. Sweet was really our biggest influence. I have to say that I hate to say it's not Led Zeppelin or Jimi Hendrix, although they were the biggest influences on my guitar playing. Sweet. To me, Sweet was the perfect combination of melody, catchiness, and hard rock.
Right.
All three. And I said, Mike, I want to sound like Sweet. Now, I don't think we did sound like Sweet, but that's kind of what I was shooting for when we were writing the song.
You can hear
the
influence that it mentions.
Even though we didn't sound like them, that was a big influence on us.
I call it the ear candy era, which is bands that they all seemed to come out in the mid-70s, right up until about 1980.
Yeah, 1980. Well, there's a reason for that. Because, you see, the record companies really do control the music business. They
sure.
control people's tastes. And what happened was a couple of those goofy new wave bands hit big around late 79, if you recall.
Right.
I can't stand that music, by the way. I think it's the worst music
yeah.
that ever was created.
Don't open that can of worms.
I mean, I don't mind saying it, but the Talking Heads, Elvis Costello, to me, it's all garbage.
Ah.
I know they're talented. Mm-hmm. I know people love Elvis Costello. He has written some great songs, don't get me wrong. Even his name bothers me. He chose Elvis Presley and Lou
yeah.
Costello.
Sure.
That's where he got that from. It's like, you know, go back across the pond, pal. And I just don't like the guy. I, in any way, shape, or form, I don't like that whole style of entertaining, if you want to call it that.
So you're not a fan of Joy Division?
Just don't like it. So that shit started hitting big. And what happened was, they weren't releasing rock albums anymore. And it was a really big mistake on the record company's part, because if you think about it, that was also the same era where AC/DC and Van Halen got to be their hugest, 1980, right?
Right.
Right. So the record companies were so short-sighted, they just kept signing all these goofy-ass new wave bands, one worse than the other. The only one that I found to be great out of that group was Squeeze. I love that group.
Squeeze, big fan here, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there might be another one if I really dug deep. So what they did was they cut off hard rock for a while, you know? And groups like us that were caught in between, you know, we asked our manager, we said, look, we hate Capitol Records. We will not make another album for them. Oh, he goes, they want you to make a new album. He said, well, then it's going to be all cover tunes. I'm going to do them really badly.
Huh.
And he said, well, what should I say to them? I said, tell them what I just told you. That's how we feel about it. And we were regrouping. It was only going to be me, Michael, and Doobie, and we were looking for two new guys, and we were trying to get a deal, and because he said, okay, I'll tell them. So he got us out of the deal, but what he didn't tell us, or he didn't know maybe, was that the labels weren't signing rock groups. So the only rock groups that were making albums were ones that were already signed. And basically the only two that made it through that time period are Van Halen and AC/DC. Now, these European groups like Judas Priest and the Scorpions and Judas Priest and the Scorpions is the great example. They stayed big in Europe, big enough that they were making money and they could keep it going. But we didn't know Europe was even a viable market. We were over here. I got to be honest with you. We had no idea. So we just broke up, you know, and Michael and I put that new thing together I told you about, Hellcats. But those groups made it into that 1983-84 zone where it was just starting with Rat and Def Leppard and Bon Jovi, you know, was starting to have rock hits and stuff. And that's when the rock, when rock came back,
yeah.
you know. And then, of course, the record company said, now let's sign every hard rock group we can until they started signing the worst rock groups on earth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what record companies do. They have no creativity.
Oversaturation.
They see something is catching
yeah.
on, so then they sign every stupid band they can until they ruin the genre.
Where
they did
it was
the same
like the,
thing
that way
after
that,
that, they did,
that a whole
yeah.
wave of the British bands in around 1980, where you know that were the even the ones that crossed over from the 70s, like Priest, and then you had newer bands like Maiden come in, and then
right.
by 84, 85, they were all coming out of L.A. or the West Coast, for that matter.
Right, right, right. And then of course the grunge thing where they signed.
Yeah.
I mean, really, you can't really say too much bad about the first three: Nirvana, Pearl Jam, and Soundgarden.
Yeah.
But after that, it gets real thin.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you about Hellcats, the second record, because the two records, the two Hellcats records, were very different vastly different in sound and style. The first one that had Michael on it.
Yeah.
You're still in 1982. It sounds more like Stars than the second record sounds.
Well,
you know, like
we're
Hellcats.
At
it was 87.
Same studio.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
even your guitar
plant.
Tone kind of changed. It just the drum sound. It kind of Hellcats 2. It's already 1987. So were you guys deliberately just using 80s trends that were kind of big at the time, or was it who produced that?
No, Brendan Harkin and I produced that. But the thing was that we were limited to the studio, and we were doing it in his basement recording studio. He didn't have, you know, like record plant style equipment, you know, and I think we were just limited to the equipment, and that's why it came out sounding like that. It wasn't the big sound of the record plant, which is where that first one was done. We even did it with the same engineer we did the Stars albums with,
right?
And it had the same feel, the same sound, in the same room. We did it in the same room as we did the first two Stars albums. And but when we were doing it in this little studio in New Jersey, we couldn't get those sounds. That's all it was, really.
It just seems to me that those albums are two perfect examples of the difference in, and I know Hellcats 1 was 82, but the difference in what rock, hard rock sounded like in the 70s and early 80s versus what rock, hard rock, and metal became in the 80s. There was a vastly different sound, and you got to know what I'm talking about. I don't know if I can describe it in words.
Wait, yes and no, because it really has to do with the producer. If you think about the stuff that Bob Rock produced, now it doesn't sound 70s, true, but it's really big. Like if you think about the Metallica album that he did, if you think about the Cult Sonic Temple album, I think Motley Crue, Dr. Feelgood maybe, those are big sounding albums. They sound great, but they are different. They're more like tighter produced, kind of slick, more slick production.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and that's with the big drum sound. The guitar sound is much more compressed and distorted.
Well, it's the Mutt Lange sound is what it is.
I don't know.
They all copied Mutt Lange's style of producing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And it's got nothing to do with that. It's just like the move from analog to digital, the difference between recording at...
It does have a lot to do with that.
It does. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I'm doing everything digital. I have a studio in my basement for the last, I don't know, 7 or 8 years. Nothing tremendous. It's all digital, but it's really hard to record. I can't even record drums. I can't record drums properly. I won't even attempt it at this point. Mm-hmm. And so I have to go to a studio to do the drums and then bring them here and do, you know, everything else on top of it. And I still feel like it's kind of demo-ish. You know what I mean? It's not what I'm really looking for. The whole big room studio thing is pretty much down the tubes, you know? It's really a shame.
Jack Douglas recorded you guys live, right? He was a good producer to have. He was he was good at letting bands be themselves and kind of instead of altering your sounds.
He wasn't a takeover producer. He was make you sound great with what you do.
Yes, yes. He wasn't one of those guys that just like kind of left this stamp on everything. And
great producer. Great producer. I mean, the reason we got him is because I was a big fan of Get Your Wings. And I still think that's Aerosmith's greatest album. And the sound on that album, it was my favorite album of the year, 1974. And when we came to looking for a producer, I threw his name in a hat there, and everybody said, yeah, that's a pretty good album. And nobody argued. So O'Coin said, I'll go see what he says. And he came to a gig we did in Atlanta and loved us, and we hit it off great, and we started working with him. He was just great to work with.
Sean Delaney introduced you to Bill O'Coin. Is that accurate?
Well, let me go back now to my audition, because
we kind of left off with that story.
If you want to hear it, it's a pretty cool story.
Yes.
What happened was, I told you my former guitar roadie in Stories, his name was Tom Butler. He's still around somewhere. He's on Facebook. I've seen him. We're friends. He saw that Rocksteady Management had a band looking for a guitar player and knew that I was trying to get something together to bring over to Bill, and said, this is right up your alley. Give it a call. So he said, here's the number. I said, you know, I thanked him. I called the number. Sean Delaney answered the phone. He goes, And Sean Delaney was a fanatical, like, intense guy. Really great guy, I have to say. Nothing bad to say about him. And he got on the phone with me and he goes, "Are you the greatest guitar player ever?" I said, "No, I don't think so." So he goes, "Well, we already got the greatest guitar player, so unless you're the greatest guitar player, we don't need you." I said, "No, I guess you don't need me." So I said, "And why would you need me if you already had the greatest guitar player?" "Because we want two of them." I said, "Oh, yeah?" Now I'm ready to say, "Fuck you," okay? But I said to myself, well, it is rock steady. I was just about to hang up the phone and thought to myself, it is rock steady. I've been kind of working towards getting over there anyway. All right, I said, I'll come down. So it was all the way down in Chinatown, and they had a loft. So, I mean, normally when I'm doing a, back in those days when I was doing an audition, I would get, you know, dressed up to look like a rock star, but I was so disgusted with the way this guy was talking to me on the phone. I don't even think I combed my hair. You know what I mean? It was like I got in the car and I said to my girlfriend, who later became my ex-wife, I said to her, I said, "You want to come with me?" Now, that's not a professional thing to do, and I normally wouldn't do it. I said, "But I don't really feel like driving. I don't even feel like going. Why don't you come with me?" She said, "All right." So we walk into this loft. Sean Delaney's the first person we see. He goes, "Who's this?" I said, "This is my girlfriend." He goes, "No girls allowed." I said, "Well, it's too late." So he goes, he brings her in, and there's this, like, kitchen area or something. She goes and sits in there, and he says, "Okay, there's a couple of guys ahead of you." I said, "Great, whatever." So then those guys leave. I walk into the room. They got the equipment set up. There's a Marshall amp. They say, "There's your cord." I pick up the cord, and Brendan Harkin, the other guitar player, goes, "One, two." And I said, whoa, don't you think you should at least tell me the key of the song? I was really disgusted. I really wanted to just put the fucking cable on the ground and walk out, right? And he said, "Okay, yeah, it's key of A." I said, "Yeah, great." So nobody made eye contact with me or anything. And they started playing the song, and I'm listening to it, and I said, "Okay, there's like no guidance. They didn't tell me what the chords are, nothing. That's fine." And I listened for a few seconds. And I said, "Oh, yeah, I know what to play here." And I just started playing. And we played no more than 2 minutes, I'd say, just under 2 minutes. And Doobie, the drummer, he put the sticks down. He looked over at me, and I stopped playing. I said, "Okay, now what?" And he goes, "So what's your name?"
Well, that's good news if they're asking your name.
Yeah, I said, "Richie." Now they're all looking at me, and they're putting their instruments down. I said, "So what's up?" And they said, "So what have you been doing? You played in any other bands or anything?" I said, "Well, I was in Stories until we split up." They go, "Oh, Stories." And, well, you know, Doobie and Peter Sweevil and the keyboard player, they had a keyboard player, were original members of the Looking Glass, Brandy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is like the biggest song in the history of music somehow. Don't ask me how, but it is. It's in that Guardians of the Galaxy. I don't know if you know that.
It's one of my favorite songs, man. It would definitely make like my top 100 list, maybe.
Yeah.
I like singing at karaoke too.
And Stickman over here always sings at karaoke. So
it's a great song. Don't get me wrong, but. Yeah. The movies it's been in and the money that it's generated is beyond imagination. Mm-hmm. So at any rate, so they tell me they were in the Looking Glass, and of course they know a couple of guys in Stories. That we didn't know each other, but they knew a couple of guys. And so we're talking, and they said, "So you want to be in the band?" I said, "I guess, you know. I mean, I only played like 2 minutes with them, you know." They said, "Well, we've auditioned 73 guitar players, and one of them played what we wanted them to play except for you." So I said, "Oh." I said, "That's pretty cool." So then we immediately, they said, "You write?" I said, "Of course I write." You know, they said, "Well, we got this idea." And they showed me Fallen Angel. And I said, "Oh, what you need to do is," and I just played what became the beginning of Fallen Angel. And it was instant. It was just an instant thing. And that's the audition thing. Now, what happened was Sean Delaney had met Peter Sweevil. And I guess all these years have gone by. It doesn't really matter what I say. So Sean Delaney and Peter Sweevil were gay. And they went to gay bars in the Village. And they met each other. Peter Sweevil was the bass player in Stars. And they met each other, and Peter Sweevil told him who he was and about the Looking Glass and the Fallen Angels. So Sean mentioned that he was, you know, managing Kiss with Bill O'Coin, and they were looking for another band. And Peter said, "Why don't you come down and hear our band, which is called the Fallen Angels?" And he did. He said, "You guys are great, but you need another guitar player." So he brought them over to O'Coin. They signed them, and then they looked for another guitar player, which is where I came into the picture. And then about a month into the band, we realized that the keyboard player really didn't fit anymore because we were going to a much harder rock area. And so he left, And Sean said, you got to change the name because there's a group called Angel and there's another group called Something Angels in Australia and this and that. So he said, I got this idea, Stars. And we all said, no, we don't like it. And so he said, with a Z. I said, no, we don't like it. We all said to him, right? And then he went anyway and got a logo made up. And he showed us the logo on a Xerox piece of paper. Like, that's what he called it back then. Everything was a Xerox. Yep. It wasn't a photocopy. He showed us this thing. We all went, that's the name.
Well, it's one of the most badass logos to this day, man.
It is, yeah, it is. So that's how that all came about. Now, Sean, you know, turned out to be really an instrumental part of the band. He was at every rehearsal critiquing us. He'd listen to a song and he'd go, that part sucks. And we go, yeah, maybe you're right. Nobody got offended. We didn't argue. We just said, yeah, maybe you're right. You know, so it was really cool. His input was really great with us, and it really helped us out. And the rest is history.
Well, you know, Sean, he's very, he's like one of the unsung visionaries of,
he is.
I mean, he choreographed Kiss, man. A lot of stuff that Kiss was known for, but he was kind of the visionary behind
every move.
Oh, yeah,
don't make
that
face.
And they don't give him the credit that he's due. No. I don't know why. I don't know why they didn't. You know, like they want to take all the credit for themselves. But,
well, sure.
You know, I don't. Listen, Sean Delaney had an impact on us, and he had an impact on them for sure.
Just getting, you know, and I'm sure you're tired. You're probably sick to death of talking about it, the whole Stars thing, you know, because all the right elements were in place, producer, label, touring, everything, man. Mm-hmm. How fucking clueless was Capitol, man? How much, as far as,
Capitol was a 45-oriented label, you know, a top hit label. That's what they were at the time. Management decided to pull the promotion on Cherry Baby, which was like number 33 on the charts. It was a top 40 hit, and it was definitely headed for the top 20. I don't know about top 10, but it was definitely headed to the top 20. It was only 13 points away. And I said, what do you mean you're pulling the promotion? And they said, the office people that we would talk to from the road said, oh, yeah, this is the right thing. We're going to put all the money and all the promotion into the next single, Sing It, Shout It. I said, but you were already there. You only need 13 points. You know, back in those days in 1977, if you were a rock group, a real rock group, and you had a top 20 hit, your album went platinum. That's a big deal. And I said, you know, you guys are blowing us here. And they, oh, no, we know what we're doing. They put Sing It, Shout It out, and it went up to number 66. And all of a sudden, everything that was going great was going really bad. The label was losing interest.
But, you
I
know,
did it.
In asking, just in getting around that story, you know, as far as I was just kind of was wondering if we could cut to the heart of what went wrong, how much Capitol weighed in versus O'Coin management itself, as far as, you know, how all that stuff went down. But yeah, it's neither here nor there, man. You know, and I'm sure you're tired of talking about that.
Yeah, I am. It's just water under the bridge, really. It doesn't matter. You know, you can't change it. It's just part of life. I've lived a lot of years since then. You know, I've been married with two kids. Now I'm married again with two kids. And that's really like a much more important part of my life, believe it or not, than music.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it gives you a good perspective to have kids and have
And I'll tell you what, on that note, man, doing music that you're not necessarily associated with, man, your cover of The Wallflowers, One Headlight, I really enjoyed, man. I love the video, man. I've watched the video like 10 freaking times, man, in the last month. There's something about the video that's just kind of this is fucking cool. You know,
thank you. You know, it was just a complete mistake, the whole thing. I gotta be honest with you. I just was trying to learn how to sing the song, so I just played a guitar and put a drum beat down.
Yeah.
And I just sang to it till I got the whole thing. I said, oh, now that I got it, because I'd added a bass and another guitar, I said, this really sounds good. And I recorded the vocal. I said, yeah, this came out really good. And then at the same time, a friend of mine had bought the Final Cut Pro video editing software. Mm-hmm. And a good friend of mine is an expert at that. Well, I paid him, and I took lessons on how to learn how to do video. And I said, well, rather than learning on an original song, let me just throw this last thing I did there. I'll do a video and learn how to edit video to this song.
Uh-huh.
And that's where that all came from. And it came out so nice. I just said, I'll put it up on YouTube. Nobody will care, but it'll be fun.
in your song, Angel of Love, man, I got to tell you, man, is one of the most gorgeous pieces of music I've ever heard by anybody.
Oh, wow. Thank you. I did it for my wife.
Very, very lured to that song, man. I keep returning to it because knowing that, you know, that we had a conversation coming up with you, and you're just trying to do my homework on various parts of your career that I wasn't too schooled on. So there were a lot of little gems that I discovered, and that was one of them.
Thank you. I was happy with that song. Yeah, it was a cool song.
A couple of other songs I want to ask you about.
Mm-hmm.
What is Waitress? It's dated 1980. What is that?
Okay, well, I'll tell you what it is. In 1979, Starz split up for the first time. And Doobie, I was already really close friends with Peter Scants from, because he lived one town away from me when we grew up and stuff. And he's a great, great player, great bass player. And his brother had an appendicitis attack, and his band got screwed up. His brother was a great guitar player, and he was in the hospital, and he couldn't do gigs for months. So Peter said, if you and Doobie can do the gigs, we'll do them as a trio, all these gigs I got coming up, as long as you guys aren't working right now. So we said, sure, and we started a group, and next thing you know, we were playing all over the place. It was called Hardcore, before Hardcore Punk became the actual name for Hardcore Punk. And we came up with that name. We were playing around, and we were writing some songs and having some fun, and that stupid song, my ex-wife, who I was married to at the time, had done some waitressing, and we were just talking about it one day, and we just came up with that whole stupid thing. You know, it's pretty funny.
It's funny that you say stupid, because it's consistent with your description of new wave as stupid.
Yeah.
And it's very new wave. And yeah. I really think, like, I'm listening to that, and I'm like, this is a fucking hit. Like, this is a new wave hit, man.
It was a new. I thought so too. It was 1980, and we had Jan Mulaney do that crazy, like, that Cars kind of.
You know, it had that DJ sound from when David Bowie did Lodger in 78.
Yeah,
it has
we
that,
did it at the record plant, and it really came out great. We tried getting a record deal with that, but I think they just thought of us too much as being guys from Starz and not as new waivers, which is the only thing they were really signing at the time. And it was the only song like that we had. Everything else was, you know, more rock. And, you know what? You get lost between the cracks for years and years, and it's just the way it goes. I don't know. Karma? I don't know what it is, you know? I do want to tell you, there's a rock journalist who is writing a book, and we did a 2.5-hour interview right here at my house. He came over. He said he's been a rock journalist for 30 years. He's interviewed pretty much like every rock star. And one of the things he always asks musicians, he said, even to current, who were your biggest influences? What groups were your biggest influences? And he said the four groups that came up the most between all the musicians he interviewed are Aerosmith, Kiss, Cheap Trick, and Starz. And so he said he's writing a book on that.
So, you got ripped off, Richie. I don't know, man.
Yeah, no question. Yeah. The other three groups made a great living and continue to make a great living, and we just got shafted. I really believe that there is no group ever that got shafted as bad as Starz.
That would be your luck, man. Son of a bitch.
Yeah, that'd be my luck.
I tell you what, you know what, bro? You got so close to the brass ring. There's a book in you. You know, I'm sure you've seen the craziest sex, drugs, and rock and roll. You name it. I'm sure you've seen it
you
all.
You better believe it.
You know, you got... You got a lot of stuff to say, man. So
Oh yeah, it's a lot of stuff.
I'm sure you've thought about it.
I got out of it so bad. I mean, I was so far out of it, out of the music thing. I was coaching my kids in three sports during the year. That was my life, coaching my kids.
Yeah, yeah.
And just getting involved in that and getting away from anything that had to do with music.
Uh-huh.
And I was actually very happy. And but when I got since I've gotten back into music, I got into it with the right frame of mind.
Right.
And all that other stuff I can talk about, but it's almost like it was another life, another person.
Sure.
It's something that's in my memory, but it's not what I lived. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it was your 20s. It feels like another life, like you say, right?
Yeah, it's like another life. It was just something that happened.
I want to ask you about a couple of these experiences. I mean, some of the bands you guys opened up for, you opened up for so many legendary bands and singers. Can I ask you, and don't hold back, who is the funnest one, the best one to work with? And was there a band you played with that just sucked? They were a nightmare?
Yeah, I don't know if I want to say that one because...
Give somebody their props, then.
This is totally true. Foghat and Rush were the absolute nicest guys to play with. Those guys were just gems.
Everybody
sure
says that about Rush, man. That's like universal.
Yeah? Oh, God, yeah. You know what? we did a lot of gigs with Rush before they were headliners. So it was like, say, we would open, they would be in the middle, someone would be headlining. And then when they did their first headlining tour, we did most of it, the Hemispheres tour.
Mm-hmm.
Ah. And on the very first night, you know, I use a double neck for Cherry Baby. And on the first night, it didn't work, you know. And I said, well, let's go to the back room. You know, we might, I went to the back room with my roadie, and we tried a few things, and we realized he just gave me a bad chord for that song. So there's a knock on the door. He and I are the only two in the room, and it's Alex. It's between, you know, Rush is about to go on soon. He goes, hey, Richie, I saw what happened with your guitar. He goes, and he has a double neck, identical color, everything, Gibson double neck, same cream-colored, you know, guitar. He goes, you can use this for the whole rest of the tour. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
I said, wow. I said, that's really nice, Alex, but you know what? It was just a bad chord, so I'm not going to need it, but thanks so much. That's the kind of guys they were.
Yeah, good dudes. Good dudes.
Yeah.
They took care of you.
Down to earth, really nice guys. A lot of guys had big-time attitudes,
uh-huh.
and I think they were a little too competitive to the point where they were always worried you were going to steal some of their thunder, you know? By the way, Ted Nugent was great to work with, too.
Ah, cool, cool. Yeah, and you know what? Rush seems like pretty clean living guys. They're not party animals. I'm sure
that figures in too. That's right.
Ted
didn't do alcohol or drugs either.
No, he did not, right?
No, he never did any of that stuff. And Foghat were just the nicest guys. In fact, they did something that was really amazing. On the first gig, they said, we noticed you guys have like a big truck out there with equipment in it. And we said, yeah. He said, it costs a lot of money. He said, ditch that shit. You use our stuff.
Yeah? Wow, man.
So they said, well, I said, well, you got Mesa Boogie, and we use Marshall. And they said, Mesa Boogie's great. Get up there and try it on the soundcheck. So we did, and Brendan and I hated the Mesa Boogies. So we said to them, you know what? I said, you guys sound great to those Mesa Boogies, but we didn't like the way we sounded through them. So we're going to just continue with the truck and the whole bit, but thank you.
There you go.
That was a really sweet thing for them to do, you know?
That's Foghat, right, you said?
Yeah, Foghat. Yeah,
Foghat and Rush, man, good guys. Yeah, Richie Rano, you're taking the high road as always, man. Not throwing anybody under the bus. I think it's been a while since we told the listeners we got Richie Rano, man, formerly of the great '70s band Stars.
I'm not formerly up. We're still doing it.
It's, you know what? Amen, man. It's never really ended on and off.
We haven't hung the cleats up yet.
Mike wants you back, but I want to do this bit with you really quickly, man.
Okay.
I'm really getting a sense for who you are musically talking to you, you know. It's very revealing that you're not that crazy about the Joe Jackson, new wavy type guys. You are definitely a dyed-in-the-wool hard rock loyalist, I would say.
I don't know if I want to say that.
I don't want to pigeonhole you, man.
I have very diverse taste. I just don't like new wave.
All right. You see, you strike me as a guy who likes Zeppelin better than the Stones, maybe. Or am I assuming too much?
No. Everybody equal. I mean, yeah. Everybody equal.
Okay. I tell you what. If I'm going to mention an artist or a singer or a band, and you say whatever you want about them, yes, as much or as little as you want. I just want to throw a couple and get your opinion. Anything you want to say.
Okay.
Bruce Springsteen.
Well, that's a yin-yang kind of thing for me, you know? Part of me just absolutely hates him,
uh-huh.
but another part of me absolutely loves him, so I can't figure it out. I'm kind of skitzed on Springsteen.
That's very interesting. last year, we had a couple of... Let's include Tom Petty, too. Tom Petty, Prince, David Bowie, even Chuck Berry, all in the last year.
Tom Petty, David Bowie, those two right there, those two right there are probably... my two favorites of all time, Tom Petty and David Bowie.
Okay, Tom Petty and David Bowie are really close to your heart, you're saying.
Yeah, it really hurt me when they were, you know, lost it. And Glenn Frey, because I'm a big Eagles fan.
There you go, that's the one I forgot. That's one I forgot.
Oh, my God, and they were all like basically my age, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, how does this happen? You know, it's really rough. Yeah, those are three rough deals right there for me.
Let me hit you with a couple more randomly. The Ramones.
Next.
How about Metallica?
I think it took Metallica a really long time to get good. And
really?
But they were really creative right from the beginning, very unique. And what they had was really special. They really dedicated their lives to it. I mean, they came out from San Francisco and they were living in like a room in a warehouse in Queens. And they did whatever it took. And I tell you, I met Lars Ulrich, and I was sitting on a couch in a VIP room in Long Island about 25 years ago, a little bit more than 25 years ago probably. And I was friends with Sebastian Bach because he was a really big Stars fan, and we had met one time, and he was like telling me how much he loved Stars and seen us and blah, 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 when he was a young kid. And so I was hanging out with him at in the VIP room, and he goes, Richie, are you going to be here for a few minutes? I said, well, I guess. He goes, well, don't move, okay? I got somebody who really wants to meet you. He brings Lars Ulrich over. And Lars gets down on his knees and grabs my leg and starts kissing my knee.
See, goes, man, you're a fucking rock star, goes, man.
You Jesus. Have no idea how much I love you in Stars. He said, I'll get the picture quick. So he said he just, Coliseum Rock in particular had a really big impact on him and the band, he said.
It's a fine record, by the way. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's an amazing story.
I said, I don't hear it, but that's cool, man. That's great. Thank you. And I thought that was a really sweet thing that he did that day, you know.
That's a good story, man. All right, two more for you. Nirvana.
Nirvana, you know what? That initial album came out, and I thought, wow, this is absolutely amazing. Whatever it is, it's amazing. I don't think it should have taken over music completely, mm-hmm. and I don't think it really did until Pearl Jam hit big.
Right.
But I thought, you know, he wasn't necessarily a guitar player, but he could convey his... He could convey his ideas through the guitar. He had a great voice, and he had a great songwriting sensibility.
I thought he had a great voice, too. Yeah.
Truly a great talent. It's really tragic what happened. Really tragic.
Really. The final one might go right there with the Ramones. You ready? Grateful Dead.
Mike, you know, here's what I got to tell you now. When I was very young, the first three albums, I really liked them. I was a teenager, and I really liked them. And then I saw them at Woodstock, and they were horrible. I mean, they were beyond bad. You couldn't get any worse than they were at Woodstock. And I did see Jerry do an interview where he actually admitted to that. So
yeah,
I wasn't wrong.
And you know what? And they're really, really bad, but you're looking around, and you're the only one that feels that way, right? All the hippies are dancing.
Well, the thing, yeah, they didn't know. They didn't even know that the Dead were actually bad that day, but I did know.
Right.
So I lost interest in them at that point because they were so bad at that show. But you know what? As the years have gone by, I've realized how great a lot of their songs are, believe it or not, like... Eyes of the World, you know that song?
And wake up to find out you are the eyes of the world, yeah?
Yeah, it's a beautiful song. This, you know, Jerry's voice was really cool, and they got some great recordings out there, and you can't take it away from them. I know I used to really hate them in the 70s. I really did. But, you get to rethink things as you get older. But I still hate New Wave.
Fantastic. Richie, you've been a dynamite interview, man. We're going to continue to plug you and your products.
Richie, you've been very generous with your time. Considering this is far more than I expected. Just for talking to us as you have, man.
You guys are great, man. You guys made me feel comfortable. I appreciate that. And I appreciate that you respected some of those things that came out earlier.
Two more things, man, before we let you go. Mm-hmm. Actually, sure. Three, man, really quick, man. Tell me about, is that a streetlight or the moon? Because I want to know where the hell I came from, man. It's one of those things where I said you guys were ahead of its time, and I think that song, part of that song, and so I'm talking about the verses before it kind of gets weird, is the template for a lot of ballads in the 80s, man.
Yeah, it's really not. Yeah, it probably is.
Tell me a little bit about whatever you wanted to share with me about that song.
Well, you know, Michael wrote it. That's one of the things that Michael wrote on his own. Michael's a genius, you know. He's got genius energy. He's just an amazing, amazing singer, songwriter, really. And I can't say enough about him, you know, enough good about him. But he just came up with that, walked into the studio and said, look, I got this idea. We were basically done recording. And Jack listened to it and he said, that's great. Brendan picked up a guitar, looked at the chords that Michael was playing and played that nice thing that he did. And they just recorded it with Doobie with a snare drum and then added the strings. Got an actual string section. It was really great. I have to say, I really had nothing to do with it. It was really Michael.
Okay. All right. and just two more things before we let you go. Do you have anything that you'd like to plug? Any products or shows coming up? And also, for our listeners, where can people go online to get music or merchandise or anything, any general information on you or your work?
Well, that's a good idea, and I should have been the kind of guy that should have said those things, but I didn't. But StarCentral.com, with a Z, of course. StarCentral.com is where we have our website that has anything to do with us. And we are playing. Stars is going to play January 20th in San Antonio. There's going to be two other dates in Texas, but I don't know where they're going to be yet. And they're going to be that same weekend. And with Pat Travers opening, well, actually, Axe is opening. Are you familiar with Axe? They're great.
I remember the name.
Yeah, I remember them.
Yeah, they're great, man. I love that group. So they're opening. Pat Travers second. Pat's great also. And us. And so that's going to be in January. And that's it. That's, you know, and we're, Jimmy and I are working on a new album. And we'll see what happens.
Fantastic.
Excellent,
man.
Excellent.
Fantastic.
And, you know, I wanted to, I just remembered, man, Desert Island Disc, man. You can't avoid this. Give me three albums that you'd be stranded with. I'll let you go, man.
Well, my favorite album of all time is Ziggy Stardust.
Beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. And then it's, you know, it's there's a half dozen albums that are right there. Love Forever Changes. You ever hear that?
Love Forever Changes, 1967.
Yeah, I think it's a little later than that, but it's like 69, I think.
Okay.
But you got it. Yeah.
Okay.
And I do love the first Zeppelin album and Hotel California. And there's plenty more. Actually, the Cult Sonic Temple.
Yeah, okay. We like the Cult. We like the Cult.
In fact, I have to put the Cult Sonic Temple in the top three with Ziggy Stardust and Led Zeppelin. One.
You love Sonic Temple that much, huh?
Yeah, wow. I think it's the greatest album.
I love Edie,
yeah, I'm a big fan of Love. I like their first two albums.
Yeah, I like that too, but Sonic Temple, man. Bob Rock, another Bob Rock production.
Yeah,
that guy does.
Yeah,
he was a great producer.
Yeah.
Have you seen them live? I think they're the greatest live group I've ever seen.
The Cult.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
See, I've seen shows where I thought Ian Astbury was tanking it a little bit. I've seen shows where I thought Ian wasn't giving it
all he had. Well, you saw the Cult later, man.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not talking about in their prime.
Where did you see them?
Yeah.
Starland Ballroom here in Jersey, which is kind of in the middle of nowhere.
That wasn't a good gig. I walked out.
Well, the Sonic Temple tour was when they opened for Metallica.
I heard they weren't real great on that tour.
Yeah. I would have loved to have seen them in '85 when Love came out.
Yeah, I heard they weren't real great, but I saw them at, what's that place in the city? Roseland. Oh, my God.
Sure.
It was amazing.
Wow.
Yeah, it was amazing. And by the way, another group that I totally love, and I want you to know I can't stand punk rock either, because punk rock new wave is the same thing.
Yeah.
But but there is one group that is one of my favorites of all time, and you're going to really laugh at me, Social Distortion.
Oh, man. All right. You know, Mike Ness.
You're not alone.
Yeah,
not alone,
Mike Ness, man. I love that. I went to see him at the Starland. When you mentioned the Starland, I saw them a couple of months ago. He is phenomenal, man. Those songs are great.
You made several of our listeners very happy, man. I'm very close to a couple of guys that love
punk rock guy. Not that I really hate it. I'm just not a punk rock guy, but I don't consider them punk. I don't know. I think they're in the wrong genre.
Because Mike Ness loves country, and he's a big Johnny Cash fan, you know?
Yes, exactly right. To me, I hear that. That's what I hear. I hear that rockabilly thing going with them, you know?
Yeah. We saw them open for Neil Young and Crazy Horse about 25 years ago.
Oh, cool. I love Neil Young. I love him. In fact, my former guitar roadie in Stars did his whole last tour as Neil's guitar tech.
Oh, cool.
David Rule. He's like brilliant, man. He's like brilliant at what he does. Everything he does, actually. He's just great.
Awesome, man.
He's the guy you want having your back if you're a guitar player playing for 20,000 people, let me tell you.
Well, I've never experienced it at that level, man. You know, maybe a couple hundred at the most, but I will take your word for it. I just wrote
it. It's a great experience, you know.
Richie Rano, man, it's been great talking to you. I thank you once again. It's been an honor and a privilege to talk to you, man.
All right,
you've done our show.
Cool. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thanks for making me feel comfortable.
Take care, brother.
Okay. Take care, guys. Bye bye. I was just I spent my life, never had a love of my own. I spent my life with you. We'll make some new lives too.
There's nothing to do when it appears. You have to recognize it. I'll spend my life with you. We'll make some new lives too. Now there are four.